few years later, David joined me at college. When I was a senior and he was a sophomore, we took a class in European intellectual history together. My roommate, Carrie, also took the class, which was a huge help since she was a comparative literature major. Carrie went to all of the lectures and read all 10 of the assigned books, in the original languages, and by then, I knew what those were. I went to almost all of the lectures and read all of the books in English. David went to 2 lectures, read 1 book, and then marched himself up to our room to get tutored for the final exam. We all sat together for the test, scribbling furiously for 3 hours in our little blue books. When we walked out, we asked one another how it went. I was upset. I had forgotten to connect the Freudian id to Schopenhauer's conception of the will. Carrie, too, was concerned and confessed that she hadn't adequately explained Kant's distinction between the sublime and the beautiful. We turned to my brother. How did he feel about the test? "I got the flat one," he announced. "The flat one?" we asked. "Yeah," he said. "The flat A." He was right. He did get the flat one. Actually, we all got flat A's on the exam. My brother was not overconfident. Carrie and I were overly insecure. These experiences taught me that I needed to make both an intellectual and an emotional adjustment. I learned over time that while it was hard to shake feelings of self-doubt, I could understand that there was a distortion. I would never possess my brother's effortless confidence, but I could challenge the notion that I was constantly headed for failure. When I felt like I was not capable of doing something, I'd remind myself that I did not fail all of my exams in college, or even one. I learned to undistort the distortion. We all know supremely confident people who have no right to feel that way. We also all know people who could do so much more if only they believed in themselves. Like so many things, a lack of confidence can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. I don't know how to convince anyone to believe deep down that she is the best person for the job, not even myself. To this day, I joke that I wish I could spend a few hours feeling as self-confident as my brother. It must feel so, so good, like receiving a cosmic flat one every day. When I don't feel confident, one tactic I've learned is that it sometimes helps to fake it. I discovered this when I was an aerobics instructor in the 1980s, which meant a silver leotard, leg warmers, and a shiny headband, all of which went perfectly with my big hair. Influenced by the Gospel of Jane Fonda, aerobics also meant smiling solidly for a full hour. Some days the smile came naturally. Other days, I was in a lousy mood and had to fake it. Yet after an hour of forced smiling, I often felt cheerful. Many of us have experienced being angry with someone and then having to pretend everything's great in public. My husband Dave and I have our moments, and just when we are getting into it, it will be time to go to a friend's house for dinner. We put on our everything's great smiles, and amazingly, after a few hours, it often is. Research backs up this fake it till you feel it strategy. One study found that when people assumed a high power pose, for example, taking up space by spreading their limbs, for just 2 minutes, their dominance hormone levels, testosterone, went up, and their stress hormone levels, cortisol, went down. As a result, they felt more powerful and in charge and showed a greater tolerance for risk. A simple change in posture led to a significant change in attitude. I would not suggest that anyone move beyond feeling confident into arrogance or boastfulness. No one likes that in men or women. But feeling confident, or pretending that you feel confident, is necessary to reach for opportunities. It's a cliche, but opportunities are rarely offered. They're seized. During the 6.5 years I worked at Google, I hired a team of 4,000 employees. I did not know all of them personally, but I knew the top 100 or so. What I noticed over the years was that for the most part, the men reached for opportunities much more quickly than the women. When we announced the opening of a new office or the launch of a new project, the The men were banging down my door to explain why they should lead the charge. Men were also more likely to chase a growth opportunity even before a new opening was announced. They were impatient about their own development and believed that they were capable of doing more. And they were often right, just like my brother. The women, however, were more cautious about changing roles and seeking out new challenges. I often found myself trying to persuade them to work in new areas. I have had countless conversations where women responded to this encouragement by saying, "I'm just not sure I'd be good at that." Or, "That sounds exciting, but I've never done anything like it before." Or, "I still have a lot to learn in my current role." I rarely, if ever, heard these kinds of comments from men. Given how fast the world moves today, grabbing opportunities is more important than ever. Few managers have the time to carefully consider all the applicants for a job, much less convince more reticent people to apply. And increasingly, opportunities are not well defined, but instead come from someone jumping in to do something. That something then becomes his job. When I first joined Facebook, I was working with a team to answer the critical question of how best to grow our business. The conversations were getting heated, with many people arguing their own positions strongly. We ended the week without consensus. Dan Rose, leader of our deal team, spent the weekend gathering market data that allowed us to reframe the conversation in analytics. His effort broke the logjam. I then expanded Dan's responsibilities to include product marketing. Taking initiative pays off. It is hard to visualize someone as a leader if she is always waiting to be told what to do. Padmasree Warrior, Cisco's chief technology officer, was asked by the Huffington Post, "What's the most important lesson you've learned from a mistake you've made in the past?" She responded, "I said no to a lot of opportunities when I was just starting out because I thought, that's not what my degree is in, or I don't know about that domain." In retrospect, at a certain point, it's your ability to learn quickly and contribute quickly that matters. One of the things I tell people these days is that there is no perfect fit when you're looking for the next big thing to do. You have to take opportunities and make an opportunity fit for you, rather than the other way around. The ability to learn is the most important quality a leader can have. Virginia Romity, IBM's first female CEO, told the audience at the 2011 Fortune Most Powerful Women Summit that early in her career she was offered a big job. She worried that she lacked the proper experience and told the recruiter that she needed to think about it. That night she discussed the offer with her husband, who pointed out, "Do you think a man would have ever answered that question that way?" "What it taught me was you have to be very confident," Ginny said. "Even though you're so self-critical inside about what it is you may or may not know. And that, to me, leads to taking risks." I continue to be alarmed, not just at how we as women fail to put ourselves forward, but also at how we fail to notice and correct for this gap. And that "we" includes me. A few years ago, I gave a talk on gender issues to a few hundred employees at Facebook. After my speech, I took questions for as long as time permitted. Later that afternoon, I came back to my desk, where a young woman was waiting to talk to me. "I learned something today," she said. "What?" I asked, feeling good as I figured she was about to tell me how my words had touched her. Instead, she said, "I learned to keep my hand up." She explained that toward the end of my talk, I had said that I would take only two more questions. I did so, and then she put her hand down, along with all of the other women. But several men kept their hands up, and since hands were still waving in the air, I took more questions. Only from the men. Instead of my words touching her, her words hit me like a ton of bricks. Even though I was giving a speech on gender issues, I had been blind to one myself. If we want a world with greater equality, we need to acknowledge that women are less likely to keep their hands up. We need institutions and individuals to notice and correct for this behavior by encouraging, promoting, and championing more women. And women have to learn to keep their hands up, because when they lower them, even managers with the best intentions might not notice. When I first started working for Larry Summers, then chief economist at the World Bank, he was married to a tax attorney, Vicky. He was very supportive of Vicky's career and used to urge her to bill like a boy. His view was that the men considered any time they spent thinking about an issue, even time in the shower, as billable hours. His wife and her female colleagues, however, would decide that they were not at their best on a given day and discount hours they spent at their desks to be fair to the client. Which lawyers were more valuable to that firm? To make his point, Larry told them the story of a renowned Harvard Law School professor who was asked by a judge to itemize a bill. The professor responded that he could not, because he was so often thinking about two things at once. Even now, I'm a long way from mastering the art of feeling confident. In August 2011, Forbes put out its annual World's 100 Most Powerful Women list. I'm savvy enough to know that the list wasn't based on a scientific formula and that magazines love these features because they generate lots of page views as readers click through each name. Still, I was shocked, no, horrified, to learn that Forbes ranked me as the fifth most powerful woman in the world, right after German Chancellor Angela Merkel, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff, and the CEO of PepsiCo, Indira Nooyi. This put me ahead of First Lady Michelle Obama and Indian politician Sonia Gandhi. Absurd. My own mother called to say, "Well, dear, I do think you are very powerful, but I am not sure you are more powerful than Michelle Obama." "You think?" Far from feeling powerful, I felt embarrassed and exposed. When colleagues at Facebook stopped me in the halls to say congratulations, I pronounced the list ridiculous. When friends posted the link on Facebook, I asked them to take it down. After a few days, my longtime executive assistant, Camille Hart, summoned me into a conference room and closed the door. This was serious. She told me that I was handling the Forbes thing poorly and that I needed to stop subjecting anyone who brought up the list to a diatribe on its absurdity. I was showing too many people how uncomfortable I felt and revealing my insecurity. Instead, I needed to simply say, "Thank you." We all need colleagues like Camille, who was honest enough to point out my less than gracious response. She was right. Whether the list was ridiculous or not, I didn't write it, and I didn't have to react negatively to it. I doubt a man would have felt so overwhelmed by others' perception of his power. I know that my success comes from hard work, help from others, and being at the right place at the right time. I feel a deep and enduring sense of gratitude to those who have given me opportunities and support. I recognize the sheer luck of being born into my family in the United States rather than one of the many places in the world where women are denied basic rights. I believe that all of us, men and women alike, should acknowledge good fortune and thank the people who have helped us. No one accomplishes anything all alone. But I also know that in order to continue to grow and challenge myself, I have to believe in my own abilities. I still face situations that I fear are beyond my capabilities. I still have days when I feel like a fraud, and I still sometimes find myself spoken over and discounted, while men sitting next to me are not. But now I know how to take a deep breath and keep my hand up. I have learned to sit at the table. Chapter 3. Success and Likeability. Okay, so all a woman has to do is ignore society's expectations, be ambitious, sit at the table, work hard, and then it's smooth sailing all the way. What could possibly go wrong? In 2003, Columbia Business School professor Frank Flynn and New York University professor Cameron Anderson ran an experiment to test perceptions of men and women in the workplace. They started with a Harvard Business School case study about a real-life entrepreneur named Heidi Roizen. The case described how Roizen became a successful venture capitalist by using her outgoing personality and vast personal and professional network that included many of the most powerful business leaders in the technology sector. Flynn and Anderson assigned half of the students to read Heidi's story and gave the other half the same story with just one difference. They changed the name Heidi to Howard. Professors Flynn and Anderson then polled the students about their impressions of Heidi or Howard. The students rated Heidi and Howard as equally competent, which made sense since their accomplishments were completely identical. Yet while students respected both Heidi and Howard, Howard came across as a more appealing colleague. Heidi, on the other hand, was seen as selfish and not the type of person you would want to hire or work for. The same data with a single difference, gender, created vastly different impressions. This experiment supports what research has already clearly shown. Success and likability are positively correlated for men and negatively correlated for women. When a man is successful, he is liked by both men and women. When a woman is successful, people of both genders like her less. This truth is both shocking and unsurprising. Shocking because no one would ever admit to stereotyping on the basis of gender, and unsurprising because clearly we do. Decades of social science studies have confirmed what the Heidi Howard case study so blatantly demonstrates. We evaluate people based on stereotypes: gender, race, nationality, and age, among others. Our stereotype of men holds that they are providers, decisive, and driven. Our stereotype of women holds that they are caregivers, sensitive, and communal. Because we characterize men and women in opposition to each other, professional achievement and all the traits associated with it get placed in the male column. By focusing on her career and taking a calculated approach to amassing power, Heidi violated our stereotypical expectations of women. Yet by behaving in the exact same manner, Howard lived up to our stereotypical expectations of men. The end result? Liked him, disliked her. I believe this bias is at the very core of why women are held back. It is also at the very core of why women hold themselves back. For men, professional success comes with positive reinforcement at every step of the way. For women, even when they're recognized for their achievements, they are often regarded unfavorably. Journalist Shankar Vedantam once cataloged the derogatory descriptions of some of the first female world leaders. England's Margaret Thatcher, he wrote, was called Attila the Hen. Golda Meir, Israel's first female prime minister, was the only man in the cabinet. President Richard Nixon called Indira Gandhi, India's first female prime minister, the old witch. And Angela Merkel, the current chancellor of Germany, has been dubbed the Iron Frau. I have seen this dynamic play out over and over. When a woman excels at her job, both male and female coworkers will remark that she may be accomplishing a lot, but is not as well liked by her peers. She is probably also too aggressive, not a team player, a bit political, can't be trusted, or difficult. At least, those are all things that have been said about me and almost every senior woman I know. The world seems to be asking why we can't be less like Heidi and more like Howard. Most women have never heard of the Heidi Howard study. Most of us are never told about this downside of achievement. Still, we sense this punishment for success. We're aware that when a woman acts forcefully or competitively, she's deviating from expected behavior. If a woman pushes to get the job done, if she's highly competent, if she focuses on results rather than on pleasing others, she's acting like a man. And if she acts like a man, people dislike her. In response to this negative reaction, we temper our professional goals. Author Ken Auletta summarized this phenomenon in The New Yorker when he observed that for women, self-doubt becomes a form of self-defense. In order to protect ourselves from being disliked, we question our abilities and downplay our achievements, especially in the presence of others. We put ourselves down before others can. During the summer between my first and second year in business school, I received a letter in the mail congratulating me on becoming a Henry Ford Scholar for having the highest first-year academic record. The check was for $714.28, an odd number that immediately signaled that several students had split the prize. When we returned to school for our second year, six men let it be known that they had won this award. I multiplied my check by seven, and it revealed a nearly round number. Mystery solved. There were seven of us, six men, and me. Unlike the other six winners, I didn't let my award status become general knowledge. I told only my closest friend, Stephen Paul, and knew he would keep my secret. On the surface, this decision might have worked against me, since grades at Harvard Business School are based 50% on class participation. Professors teach 90-minute classes and are not allowed to write anything down, so they have to rely on their memory of class discussion. When a student makes a comment that others refer to, if I can build on what Tom said, that helps the professor remember the critical points and who made them. Just as in real life, performance is highly dependent upon the reaction people have to one another. The other six Ford Scholars quickly became the most quoted speakers, as their academic standing gave them instant credibility. They also received early job offers from prestigious employers before the official recruiting period even began. One day in class, one of the exalted six made a comment that, to my mind, demonstrated that he had not even read the case being discussed. Everyone fawned all over him. I wondered if I was making a huge mistake not letting people know that I was the seventh student. It would have been nice to float through my second year of business school without even reading the material. But I never really considered going public. I instinctively knew that letting my academic performance become known was a bad idea. Years later, when I learned about the Heidi Howard case study, I understood the reason why. Being at the top of the class may have made life easier for my male peers, but it would have made my life harder. I did not reach this conclusion in a vacuum. All through my life, culturally reinforced signals cautioned me against being branded as too smart or too successful. It starts young. As a girl, you know that being smart is good in lots of ways, but it doesn't make you particularly popular or attractive to boys. In school, I was called the smartest girl in the class. I hated that description. Who wants to go to the prom with the smartest girl in the class? Senior year, my class voted me most likely to succeed, along with a boy. I wasn't going to take any chances with the prom, so I convinced my friend, who worked on the yearbook, to remove my name. I got a prom date who was fun and loved sports. In fact, he loved sports so much that 2 days before the prom, he canceled on me to go to a basketball game, saying, "I know you'll understand, since going to the playoffs is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity." I did not point out that as a high school girl, I thought going to the prom was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Luckily, I found a new date who was less of a sports fan. I never really thought about why I went to such efforts to mute my achievements from such a young age. Then, about 10 years after I graduated from business school, I was seated at dinner next to Deborah Gruenfeld, a professor of leadership and organizational behavior at Stanford, and our friendly small talk quickly turned into an intense discussion. Having studied this issue, Professor Gruenfeld was able to explain the price women pay for success. Our entrenched cultural ideas associate men with leadership qualities and women with nurturing qualities and put women in a double bind, she said. We believe not only that women are nurturing, but that they should be nurturing above all else. When a woman does anything that signals she might not be nice first and foremost, It creates a negative impression and makes us uncomfortable. If a woman is competent, she does not seem nice enough. If a woman seems really nice, she is considered more nice than competent. Since people want to hire and promote those who are both competent and nice, this creates a huge stumbling block for women. Acting in stereotypically feminine ways makes it difficult to reach for the same opportunities as men. But defying expectations and reaching for those opportunities leads to being judged as undeserving and selfish. Nothing has changed since high school. Intelligence and success are not clear paths to popularity at any age. This complicates everything, because at the same time that women need to sit at the table and own their success, doing so causes them to be liked less. Most people, myself included, really want to be liked, and not just because it feels good. Being liked is also a key factor in both professional and personal success. A willingness to make an introduction or advocate for or promote someone depends upon having positive feelings about that person. We need to believe in her ability to do the job and get along with everyone while doing it. That's why, instinctively, many of us feel pressure to mute our accomplishments. In October 2011, Jocelyn Goldfein, one of the engineering directors at Facebook, held a meeting with our female engineers where she encouraged them to share the progress they had made on the products they were building. Silence. No one wanted to toot her own horn. Who would want to speak up when self-promoting women are disliked? Jocelyn switched her approach. Instead of asking the women to talk about themselves, she asked them to tell one another's stories. The exercise became communal, which put everyone at ease. Owning one's success is key to achieving more success. Professional advancement depends upon people believing that an employee is contributing to good results. Men can comfortably claim credit for what they do as long as they don't veer into arrogance. For women, taking credit comes at a real social and professional cost. In fact, a woman who explains why she is qualified or mentions previous successes in a job interview can lower her chances of getting hired. As if this double bind were not enough to navigate, gendered stereotypes can also lead to women having to do additional work without additional reward. When a man helps a colleague, the recipient feels indebted to him and is highly likely to return the favor. But when a woman helps out, the feeling of indebtedness is weaker. She's communal, right? She wants to help others. Professor Flynn calls this the gender discount problem, and it means that women are paying a professional penalty for their presumed desire to be communal. On the other hand, when a man helps a coworker, it's considered an imposition, and he is compensated with more favorable performance evaluations and rewards, like salary increases and bonuses. Even more frustrating, when a woman declines to help a colleague, she often receives less favorable reviews and fewer rewards. But a man who declines to help? He pays no penalty. Because of these unfair expectations, women find themselves in damned if they do and doomed if they don't situations. This is especially true when it comes to negotiations concerning compensation, benefits, titles, and other perks. By and large, men negotiate more than women. A study that looked at the starting salaries of students graduating with a master's degree from Carnegie Mellon University found that 57% of the male students, but only 7% of the female students, tried to negotiate for a higher offer. But instead of blaming women for not negotiating more, we need to recognize that women often have good cause to be reluctant to advocate for their own interests, because doing so can easily backfire. There is little downside when men negotiate for themselves. People expect men to advocate on their own behalf, point out their contributions, and be recognized and rewarded for them. For men, there is truly no harm in asking. But since women are expected to be concerned with others, when they advocate for themselves or point to their own value, both men and women react unfavorably. Interestingly, women can negotiate as well as or even more successfully than men when negotiating for others, such as their company or a colleague, because in these cases, their advocacy does not make them appear self-serving. However, when a woman negotiates on her own behalf, she violates the perceived gender norm. Both male and female colleagues often resist working with a woman who has negotiated for a higher salary because she's seen as more demanding than a woman who refrained from negotiating. Even when a woman negotiates successfully for herself, she can pay a longer-term cost in goodwill and future advancement. Regrettably, all women are Heidi. Try as we might, we just can't be Howard. When I was negotiating with Facebook's founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg for my compensation, he made me an offer that I thought was fair. We had been having dinner several nights a week for more than a month and a half, discussing Facebook's mission and his vision for the future. I was ready to accept the job. No, I was dying to accept the job. My husband, Dave, kept telling me to negotiate, but I was afraid of doing anything that might botch the deal. I could play hardball, but then maybe Mark would not want to work with me. Was it worth it when I knew that ultimately I was going to accept the offer? I concluded it was not. But right before I was about to say yes, my exasperated brother-in-law, Mark Bodnick, blurted out, "Damn it, Cheryl, why are you going to make less than any man would make to do the same job?" My brother-in-law didn't know the details of my deal. His point was simply that no man at my level would consider taking the first offer. This was motivating. I went back to Mark and said that I couldn't accept, but I prefaced it by telling him, "Of course you realize that you're hiring me to run your deal teams, so you want me to be a good negotiator. This is the only time you and I will ever be on opposite sides of the table." Then I negotiated hard, followed by a nervous night wondering if I had blown it. But Mark called me the next day. He resolved the gap by improving my offer, extending the terms of my contract from 4 to 5 years, and allowing me to buy into the company as well. His creative solution not only closed the deal, but also set us up for a longer-term alignment of interests. The goal of a successful negotiation is to achieve our objectives and continue to have people like us. Professor Hannah Riley Bowles, who studies gender and negotiations at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, believes that women can increase their chances of achieving a desired outcome by doing two things in combination. First, women must come across as being nice, concerned about others, and appropriately female. When women take a more instrumental approach, "This is what I want and deserve," people react far more negatively. There is a saying, "Think globally, act locally." When negotiating, think personally, act communally. I have advised many women to preface negotiations by explaining that they know that women often get paid less than men, so they are going to negotiate rather than accept the original offer. By doing so, women position themselves as connected to a group and not just out for themselves. In effect, they are negotiating for all women. And as silly as it sounds, pronouns matter. Whenever possible, women should substitute we for I. A woman's request will be better received if she asserts, "We had a great year," as opposed to, "I had a great year." But a communal approach is not enough. According to Professor Bowles, the second thing women must do is provide a legitimate explanation for the negotiation. Men don't have to legitimize their negotiations. They are expected to look out for themselves. Women, however, have to justify their requests. One way of doing this is to suggest that someone more senior encouraged the negotiation. "My manager suggested I talk with you about my compensation," or to cite industry standards. "My understanding is that jobs that involve this level of responsibility are compensated in this range." Still, every negotiation is unique, so women must adjust their approach accordingly. Telling a current employer about an offer from another company is a common tactic, but works for men more easily than for women. Men are allowed to be focused on their own achievements, while loyalty is expected from women. Also, just being nice is not a winning strategy. Nice sends a message that the woman is willing to sacrifice pay to be liked by others. This is why a woman needs to combine niceness with insistence, a style that Mary Sue Coleman, president of the University of Michigan, calls relentlessly pleasant. This method requires smiling frequently, expressing appreciation and concern, invoking common interests, emphasizing larger goals, and approaching the negotiation as solving a problem as opposed to taking a critical stance. Most negotiations involve drawn-out, successive moves, so women need to stay focused and smile. No wonder women don't negotiate as much as men. It's like trying to cross a minefield backward in high heels. So what should we do? Should we play by the rules that others created? Should we figure out a way to put on a friendly expression while not being too nice, displaying the right levels of loyalty and using we language? I understand the paradox of advising women to change the world by adhering to biased rules and expectations. I know it is not a perfect answer, but a means to a desirable end. It is also true, as any good negotiator knows, that having a better understanding of the other side leads to a superior outcome. So at the very least, women can enter these negotiations with the knowledge that showing concern for the common good, even as they negotiate for themselves, will strengthen their position. In addition, there are huge benefits to communal effort in and of itself. By definition, all organizations consist of people working together. Focusing on the team leads to better results for the simple reason that well-functioning groups are stronger than individuals. Teams that work together well outperform those that don't. And success feels better when it's shared with others. So perhaps one positive result of having more women at the top is that our leaders will have been trained to care more about the well-being of others. My hope, of course, is that we won't have to play by these archaic rules forever, and that eventually we can all just be ourselves. We still have a long way to go. In November 2011, San Francisco Magazine ran a story on female entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley and illustrated it by superimposing the featured women's heads onto male bodies. The only body type they could imagine for successful entrepreneurship was wearing a tie or a hoodie. Our culture needs to find a robust image of female success that is first, not male, and second, not a white woman on the phone holding a crying baby. In fact, these bad mother with a briefcase images are so prevalent that writer Jessica Valenti collected them in a funny and poignant blog post called Sad White Babies with Mean Feminist Mommies. Until we can get there, I fear that women will continue to sacrifice being liked for being successful. When I first arrived at Facebook, a local blog devoted some serious pixels to trashing me. They posted a picture of me and superimposed a gun into my hand. They wrote liar in big red letters across my face. Anonymous sources labeled me two-faced and about to ruin Facebook forever. I cried. I lost some sleep. I worried that my career was over. Then I told myself it didn't matter. Then everyone else told me it didn't matter, which only reminded me that they were reading these awful comments too. I fantasized about all sorts of rejoinders, but in the end, my best response was to ignore the attacks and do my job. Arianna Huffington, founder of the Huffington Post, believes that learning to withstand criticism is a necessity for women. Early in her career, Arianna realized that the cost of speaking her mind was that she would inevitably offend someone. She does not believe it is realistic or even desirable to tell women not to care when we are attacked. Her advice is that we should let ourselves react emotionally and feel whatever anger or sadness being criticized evokes for us, and then we should quickly move on. She points to children as her role model. A child can cry one moment and run off to play the next. For me, This has been good advice. I wish I were strong enough to ignore what others say, but experience tells me I often can't. Allowing myself to feel upset, even really upset, and then move on, that's something I can do. It also helps to lean on one another. We can comfort ourselves with the knowledge that the attacks are not personal. We can joke, as Marlo Thomas did, that a man has to be Joe McCarthy in order to be called ruthless. All a woman needs to do is put you on hold. Real change will come when powerful women are less of an exception. It is easy to dislike senior women because there are so few. If women held 50% of the top jobs, it would just not be possible to dislike that many people. Sharon Mears was motivated to write Getting to 50-50 after observing this kind of tipping point firsthand. In the late 1990s, Amy Goodfriend was chosen to lead Goldman Sachs' U.S. derivatives team and later became the first female partner in the equities division. It was a seismic event and caused four senior men to quit the group. Amy faced a lot of skepticism and criticism. Before Sharon joined the team, a male friend told her, "Amy's a bitch, but an honest bitch." Sharon found that Amy was a great boss, and over the next few years, the derivatives group was transformed under her leadership. Once there were more than five female managing directors in the division, a critical mass, the negativity and grumbling began to die down. It became normal to have female leaders, and by 2000, the stigma seemed to have dissipated. Sadly, when those senior women later left and the critical mass shrank, the faith that women could be as successful as their male peers shrank with it. Everyone needs to get more comfortable with female leaders, including female leaders themselves. Since 1999, editor Patty Sellers of Fortune magazine has overseen an annual conference that she calls the Most Powerful Women Summit. On my first night there in 2005, I was in the lounge with two close friends, Diana Farrell, then head of the McKinsey Global Institute, and Sue Decker, then CFO of Yahoo. We were talking about the name of the conference, and I mentioned that when I saw the title on Google's corporate calendar, I ran to find Camille to ask her to change the name to Fortune Women's Conference. Diana and Sue laughed and said that they had done the exact same thing. Later, Patty explained that she and her colleagues chose this name on purpose, to force women to confront their own power and feel more comfortable with that word. I still struggle with this. I am fine applying the word powerful to other women, the more the better, but I still shake my head in denial when it is applied to me. The nagging voice in the back of my head reminds me, as it did in business school, don't flaunt your success, or even let people know about your success. If you do, people won't like you. Less than 6 months after I started at Facebook, Mark and I sat down for my first formal review. One of the things he told me was that my desire to be liked by everyone would hold me back. He said that when you want to change things, you can't please everyone. If you do please everyone, you aren't making enough progress. Mark was right. Chapter 4. It's a jungle gym, not a ladder. About a month after I joined Facebook, I got a call from Lori Goller, a highly regarded senior director of marketing at eBay. I knew Lori a bit socially, but she made it clear this was a business call and cut to the chase. "I want to apply to work with you at Facebook," she said. "So I thought about calling you and telling you all the things I'm good at and all the things I like to do. Then I figured that everyone was doing that. So instead, I want to ask you, what is your biggest problem and how can I solve it?" My jaw hit the floor. I had hired thousands of people over the previous decade, and no one had ever said anything remotely like that. People usually focus on finding the right role for themselves, with the implication that their skills will help the company. Lori put Facebook's needs front and center. It was a killer approach. I responded, "Recruiting is my biggest problem, and yes, you can solve it." Lori never dreamed she would work in recruiting, but she jumped in. She even agreed to drop down a level since this was a new field for her and she was willing to trade seniority for acquiring new skills. Lori did a great job running recruiting and within months was promoted to her current job, leading people at Facebook. When I asked her recently if she wanted to go back to marketing someday, she responded that she believes human resources allows her to have a greater overall impact. The most common metaphor for careers is a ladder, but this concept no longer applies to most workers. As of 2010, the average American had 11 jobs from the ages of 18 to 46 alone. This means that the days of joining an organization or corporation and staying there to climb that one ladder are long gone. Lori often quotes Patty Sellers, who conceived a much better metaphor. Careers are a jungle gym, not a ladder. As Lori describes it, ladders are limiting. People can move up or down, on or off. Jungle gyms offer more creative exploration. There's only one way to get to the top of a ladder, but there are many ways to get to the top of a jungle gym. The jungle gym model benefits everyone, but especially women who might be starting careers, switching careers, getting blocked by external barriers, or re-entering the workforce after taking time off. The ability to forge a unique path with occasional dips, detours, and even dead ends presents a better chance for fulfillment. Plus, a jungle gym provides great views for many people, not just those at the top. On a ladder, most climbers are stuck staring at the butt of the person above. A jungle gym scramble is the best description of my career. Younger colleagues and students frequently ask me how I planned my path. When I tell them that I didn't, they usually react with surprise, followed by relief. They seem encouraged to know that careers do not need to be mapped out from the start. This is especially comforting in a tough market where job seekers often have to accept what is available and hope that it points in a desirable direction. We all want a job or a role that truly excites and engages us. This search requires both focus and flexibility. So I recommend adopting two concurrent goals: a long-term dream and an 18-month plan. I could never have connected the dots from where I started to where I am today. For one thing, Mark Zuckerberg was only 7 years old when I graduated from college. Also, back then, technology and I did not exactly have a great relationship. I used Harvard's computer system only once as an undergraduate to run regressions for my senior thesis on the economics of spousal abuse. The data was stored on large, heavy, magnetic tapes that I had to lug in big boxes across campus, cursing the entire way and arriving in a sweaty mess at the Seoul Computer Center, which was populated exclusively with male students. I then had to stay up all night spinning the tapes to input the data. When I tried to execute my final calculations, I took down the entire system. That's right. Years before Mark famously crashed that same Harvard system, I beat him to it. When I graduated from college, I had only the vaguest notion of where I was headed. This confusion was in deep contrast to my father's clear conviction of what he wanted to do from a young age. When my dad was 16, he felt a sharp abdominal pain during a basketball practice. My grandmother, good Jewish mother that she was, assumed it was hunger and fed him a big dinner. That made it worse. He ended up in the hospital, where he was diagnosed with acute appendicitis. But because he had eaten, they couldn't operate for 12 excruciating hours. The next morning, a surgeon removed his appendix, and along with it, the pain. My father chose his career that day, deciding that he would become a physician so he could help ease other people's suffering. My mother shared my father's desire to help others. She was only 11 when she heard her rabbi give a sermon on the importance of civil rights and tikkun olam, a Hebrew phrase that means repairing the world. She responded to the call, grabbing a tin can and knocking on doors to support civil rights workers in the South. She has remained a passionate volunteer and human rights activist ever since. I grew up watching my mother work tirelessly on behalf of persecuted Jews in the Soviet Union. She and her friend Marjorie Sanford would write heartfelt appeals calling for the release of political prisoners. In the evenings, my dad would join them. Thanks to the collective efforts of concerned people all over the world, many lives were saved. Throughout my childhood, my parents emphasized the importance of pursuing a meaningful life. Dinner discussions often centered on social injustice and those fighting to make the world a better place. As a child, I never thought about what I wanted to be, but I thought a lot about what I wanted to do. As sappy as it sounds, I hoped to change the world. My sister and brother both became doctors, and I always believed I would work at a nonprofit or in government. That was my dream. And while I don't believe in mapping out each step of a career, I do believe it helps to have a long-term dream or goal. A long-term dream does not have to be realistic or even specific. It may reflect the desire to work in a particular field or to travel throughout the world. Maybe the dream is to have professional autonomy or a certain amount of free time. Maybe it's to create something lasting or win a coveted prize. Some goals require more traditional paths. Anyone who aspires to become a Supreme Court justice should probably start by attending law school. But even a vague goal can provide direction, a far-off guidepost to move toward. With an eye on my childhood dream, the first job I took out of college was at the World Bank as research assistant to Larry Summers, who was serving a term as chief economist. Based in Washington, D.C., the bank's mission is to reduce global poverty. I spent my first 9 months in the stacks of the bank library on the corner of 19th and Pennsylvania, looking up facts and figures for Larry's papers and speeches. Larry then generously arranged for me to join an India Health field mission to get a closer look at what the bank actually did. Flying to India took me into an entirely different world. The team was working to eradicate leprosy, which was endemic in India's most remote and poorest regions. The conditions were appalling. Due to the stigma of the disease, patients were often exiled from their villages and ended up lying on dirt floors in awful places that passed for clinics. Facts and figures could never have prepared me for this reality. I have the deepest respect for people who provide hands-on help to those in crises. It is the most difficult work in the world. I returned to D.C. with a plan to attend law school, but Lant Pritchett, an economist in Larry's office, who has devoted his life to the study of poverty, persuaded me that business school would be a better alternative. I headed back to Cambridge. I tried to stay socially conscious by joining the highly unpopular nonprofit club. I also spent my second year studying social marketing, how marketing can be used to solve social problems, with Professor Kash Rangan. One of the cases we worked on concerned the shortage of organ donations, which results in 18 deaths each day in the United States alone. I never forgot this case, and 17 years later, Facebook worked with organ registries around the world to launch a tool to encourage donor registration. After business school, I took a job as a consultant at McKinsey & Company in Los Angeles. The work never entirely suited me, so I stayed for only a year and then moved back to D.C. to join Larry, who was now Deputy Secretary of the Treasury Department. At first, I served as his special assistant. Then, when he was named secretary, I became his chief of staff. My job consisted of helping Larry manage the operations of the department and its $14 billion budget. It gave me the opportunity to participate in economic policy at both a national and an international level. I also ran point on some smaller projects, including the administration's proposal to promote the development of vaccines for infectious diseases. During my 4 years at Treasury, I witnessed the first technology boom from a distance. Its impact was obvious and appealing, even beyond being able to wear jeans to work. Technology was transforming communication and changing lives not just in the United States and developed countries, but everywhere. My long-term dream instinct kicked in. When President Clinton's administration ended, I was out of a job and decided to move to Silicon Valley. In retrospect, this seems like a shrewd move, but in 2001, it was questionable at best. The tech bubble had burst, and the industry was still reeling from the aftershocks. I gave myself 4 months to find a job, but hoped it would take fewer. It took almost a year. My Silicon Valley job search had some highs, like getting to meet my business crush, eBay CEO Meg Whitman. It also had some lows, like meeting with a high-level executive who started my interview by stating that her company would never even consider hiring someone like me, because government experience could not possibly prepare anyone to work in the tech industry. It would have been so cool to have thanked her for being honest and walked out of her office. But alas, I was never cool. I sat there hemming and hawing until every last molecule of oxygen had been sucked from the room. True to her word, she never even considered hiring me. Fortunately, not everyone shared her view. Eric Schmidt and I had met several times during my Treasury years, and I went to see him just after he became CEO of the then relatively unknown Google. After several rounds of interviews with Google's founders, they offered me a job. My bank account was diminishing quickly, so it was time to get back to paid employment and fast. In typical, and yes, annoying, MBA fashion, I made a spreadsheet and listed my various opportunities in the rows and my selection criteria in the columns. I compared the roles, the level of responsibility, and so on. My heart wanted to join Google in its mission to provide the world with access to information. But in the spreadsheet game, the Google job fared the worst by far. I went back to Eric and explained my dilemma. The other companies were recruiting me for real jobs with teams to run and goals to hit. At Google, I would be the first business unit general manager, which sounded great, except for the glaring fact that Google had no business units and therefore nothing to actually manage. Not only was the role lower in level than my other options, but it was entirely unclear what the job was in the first place. Eric responded with perhaps the best piece of career advice that I have ever heard. He covered my spreadsheet with his hand and told me not to be an idiot. Also a great piece of advice. Then he explained that only one criterion mattered when picking a job: fast growth. When companies grow quickly, there are more things to do than there are people to do them. When companies grow more slowly or stop growing, there is less to do and too many people to not be doing them. Politics and stagnation set in and everyone falters. He told me, if you're offered a seat on a rocket ship, you don't ask what seat. You just get on. I made up my mind that instant. Google was tiny and disorganized, but it was a rocket ship. And even more important to me, it was a rocket ship with a mission I believed in deeply. Over the years, I have repeated Eric's advice to countless people, encouraging them to reduce their career spreadsheets to one column: potential for growth. Of course, not everyone has the opportunity or the desire to work in an industry like high tech. But within any field, there are jobs that have more potential for growth than others. Those in more established industries can look for the rocket ships within their companies, divisions or teams that are expanding. And in careers like teaching or medicine, the corollary is to seek out positions where there is high demand for those skills. For example, in my brother's field of pediatric neurosurgery, There are some cities with too many physicians, while others have too few. My brother has always elected to work where his expertise would be in demand so he can have the greatest impact. Just as I believe everyone should have a long-term dream, I also believe everyone should have an 18-month plan. I say 18 months because 2 years seems too long and 1 year seems too short, but it does not have to be any exact amount of time. Typically, my 18-month plan sets goals on two fronts. First and most important, I set targets for what my team can accomplish. Employees who concentrate on results and impact are the most valuable, like Lori, who wisely focused on solving Facebook's recruiting problem before focusing on herself. This is not just thinking communally, the expected and often smart choice for a woman, but simply good business. Second, I try to set more personal goals for learning new skills in the next 18 months. It's often painful, but I ask myself, how can I improve? If I am afraid to do something, it is usually because I am not good at it, or perhaps am too scared even to try. After working at Google for more than 4 years, managing well over half of the company's revenues, I was embarrassed to admit that I had never negotiated a business deal. Not one. So I gathered my courage and came clean to my boss, Omid Kordestani, then head of sales and business development. Omid was willing to give me a chance to run a small deal team. In the very first deal I attempted, I almost botched the whole thing by making an offer to our potential partner before fully understanding their business. Fortunately, my team included a talented negotiator, Shailesh Rao, who stepped in to teach me the obvious. Letting the other side make the first offer is often crucial to achieving favorable terms. Everyone has room to improve. Most people have a style in the workplace that overshoots in one direction, too aggressive or too passive, too talkative or too shy. In that first deal, I said too much. This was not a shock to anyone who knows me. Once I identified this weakness, I sought help to correct it. I turned to Maureen Taylor, a communications coach, who gave me an assignment. She told me that for 1 week, I couldn't give my opinion unless asked. It was one of the longest weeks of my life. If I had bitten my tongue each time I started to express my opinion, I would have had no tongue left. Trying to overcorrect is a great way to find middle ground. In order for me to speak the right amount in a meeting, I have to feel as if I am saying very little. People who are shy will have to feel like they are saying way too much. I know a woman who naturally talks softly and forces herself to shout in business meetings just to speak at an average volume. Overriding our natural tendencies is very difficult. In all the years I've been trying, I can only think of a few times when someone said to me, "Cheryl, I wish you had spoken up more in that meeting." Omid did it once, and I hugged him. Eric turned out to be absolutely right about Google, and I will always be grateful to him and to Larry Page and Sergey Brin for taking a chance on me. My 18-month plan at the company extended into 6.5 years, and I learned more than I ever could have hoped while working with true visionaries. But eventually, I felt that it was time to make a move on the jungle gym. In my personal life, I am not someone who embraces uncertainty. I like things to be in order. I file documents in colored folders, yes, still. And my enthusiasm for reorganizing my closet continually baffles Dave. But in my professional life, I have learned to accept uncertainty and even embrace it. Risk and a great deal of luck landed me at Google. That worked out so well that I decided to embrace risk again, which led me to Facebook. At the time, other companies were willing to hire me as CEO. But I joined Facebook as COO. At first, people questioned why I would take a lower-level job working for a 23-year-old. No one asks me that anymore. As I did when I joined Google, I prioritized potential for fast growth and the mission of the company above title.